Hello, everyone. As you're still eating, we're slowly moving into the second panel and the second presentation today. My name is Florian Sichling. I'm a social worker from Germany and a third-year PhD student here at the School of Social Service Administration. As a young academic in training, it's always a great pleasure to meet scholars whose work has not only shaped the respective field, but has had a profound impact on my own education. Professor Joel Handler is one of these scholars. He is the Richard C. Maxwell Professor of Law and Professor of Policy Studies at the School of Public Policy and Social Science Research at the University of California, Los Angeles. He was elected a fellow to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2004. Professor Handler has published widely on poverty and welfare reform, but as a non-US student, I particularly appreciate his sustained effort to move beyond national boundaries. Systems for the provision and maintenance of social welfare are changing rapidly throughout Western Europe and the United States, and I believe that much can be learned from a comparative perspective. Despite significant differences among European welfare states and between them and the United States, Handler has argued that many Western European nations are indeed moving towards a US consensus on welfare reform to integrate socially excluded through workfare rather than social rights and entitlements. From a US perspective, Handler has been an outspoken critic of the corrosion of social rights and entitlements that were associated with notions of social citizenship. Particularly as a social worker, I want to note the strong sense of commitment and compassion towards the most marginalized and disadvantaged segments in our societies that is evident throughout Handler's writing. And with that, I would like for you to join me in welcoming Professor Joel Handler.
Thank you for that very nice introduction. Before I arrived here, I got an email from Evelyn, and she said to me, don't say too much about the American welfare state because we'll have heard it all morning long. Concentrate mostly on the Western European welfare state. But then I began to scratch my head. I'm going to concentrate on the European welfare state with all the Europeans here. It's sort of a risky proposition. Well, we did hear a lot about the American welfare state, and I can't resist, though, making a couple of summary comments, which I will then relate to my discussion of the Western European states. The distinguishing characteristic of the United States welfare state, which is really in sharp contrast, has been from day one in the colonial period, the distinction between the deserving and the undeserving poor. And the undeserving poor were those who were, or always have been, considered to be eligible or should be in the paid labor force. Now, it was not only a question of employability and ability to work, but it was a very, very big issue of moral framing. You were a deviant. You were morally problematic. And it was emphasized by Zeke Hassenfeld and several of the other speakers. A very, very significant aspects of this were both gender and race. You cannot consider American politics, or really just about anything about America, without considering the influence of race. And in the colonies of Rhode Island, They would give money to single mothers. There were a lot of men, single families in those days, men lost at sea, the French and Indian Wars, etc. They would give monies to a white widow, single parents, and place their children. But if you were black or Indian, they told you to get out of town. And that's been that has been persistent. And it was not only race, but it was also religion was always a very serious issue. And you read Linda Gordon's accounts of welfare in the 19th century, you know, I mean, really serious discrimination against the Irish Catholics, and then later, you know, Jews, Italians, people from Southern Europe. So this has been a tremendous part of our welfare history, and as I'll talk about in a minute, not a issue in Europe, although maybe now starting to rise with the increase in immigration. The other interesting thing, which is kind of contradictory with this conference, is at least, you know, in 1996, we have ended welfare as we know it. And it really has dropped off the radar screen. It came back a little bit with Katrina, you know, the big hurricane in New Orleans. But for the since 1996, there's been virtually, practically no discussion of welfare and poverty. Now, the rolls went down dramatically even before 1996, but between 1996 and 2001, we had a full employment, and contrary to what our mothers tell us, the vast majority of welfare recipients are low-wage workers, they're in the labor market, and there were plenty of jobs. But since 2001, we've had very, very severe unemployment, particularly in the low-wage labor market. But as Professor Hassenfeld and others have told us, the welfare rolls have not gone up. They've remained static. There have been sanctions. There have been diversion. But also, what is really disturbing is there hasn't been any real research on what is happening to these people. What is happening to the poor single mother in poverty? How are they living? How are they the same? I mean, a little study here and there, but you still, I mean, the major research institutes, the policies and stuff like that, you know, aren't focused on this at all. And of course, our President Obama, you may have noticed, never once mentioned welfare during the presidential campaign, and he has not mentioned welfare since the election. So we're here talking, but it's hard to be not to be pessimistic about asking the question, who's listening? nevertheless, well, following Evelyn's instructions and looking at the European welfare states, and my European friends will know I'm very hesitant about this. You say, okay, Joel, you know, but it's not quite like this. And I'm sure that'll be in the comments too. There are four clusters of the European welfare states. There's the Scandinavian, the continental, the Anglo-Saxon, and Southern Europe. I'll be discussing mostly the first two clusters, the Scandinavian and the continental. The Anglo-Saxon is, you know, in the United States and Canada are pretty much similar, and the southern states are quite a bit different. In looking at the Scandinavian and the continental countries, the contrast between these countries and the United States could not be more pronounced. Whereas the U.S. is organized on the distinction between the deserving and the undeserving poor and allocates between the various state and local governments, the Scandinavian and continental systems are founded on solidarity and redistribution. They're administered at the national level, although quite often jointly with labor unions and employer associations. Maurizio Ferreira states, According to a recent Eurobarometer survey, 95% of EU citizens think that, quote, helping others, close quote, is extremely important. Moreover, significant majorities of respondents consider equality and the spirit of cooperation and solidarity and social security and welfare as precious legacies of the 20th century. The readiness to engage in social sharing and the support of those public programs that organizing sharing practices within society stand out as a deep-seated trait of the civic and political culture of Europeans, a trait which sets them apart from their cousins in North America. Well, starting with the Bismarckian era and solidifying in later years, the European welfare states, again primarily Scandinavian and the continental, became universal and comprehensive. They took years to develop, and they took different paths. There were distinct programs. They were nevertheless characterized by this approach. In the 1960s and 1970s, the exemplary welfare states had grew and developed. Oil was the main source of energy, and there was increased growth in productivity. The unions were incorporated into industry-wide bargaining, where they would restrain wage demands in return for expanded, more inegalitarian prices. In most countries, there were real increases in both wages and welfare state entitlements. There were considerable differences, but from the perspective of the United States and the UK, the defining characteristic was the extension of social rights. Social rights were granted on the basis of citizenship. Benefits were universal and solidaristic. However, work was a central element of the European welfare state. For example, Sweden offered very generous benefits, family benefits, but to qualify, women must have worked in the paid labor force. And labor force participation was also, in Sweden, was the highest in Europe, although in Germany, in contrast, it was quite low. In addition, there were very extensive labor protections. There was job security, long-term labor contracts, etc. Then things began to change. But I'll get into that in a second. For those people who were not in the paid labor force, these were people who were below the paid labor force, primarily unemployed youth who had left school but did not make employment connections, older redundant workers who became unemployed, lone parents, the European term for single mothers, and immigrants. Most of this group, in contrast to the United States, most of this group received social assistance. For the most part, there was no other requirements other than citizenship in need. If you were a citizen and you were poor, you would get a social citizen's benefit. There were some, you know, work requirements, some other conditions, but they were not really enforced very much. Now, significant changes began to occur in the 1970s after the work shocks, after the oil shocks. And the welfare changes began to be changed from what was called passive, like the social assistance, to active. there were two significant clusters of changes. Flexible labor market protections were introduced, and also for welfare activation. The financial leaders, the European Union, the international financial institutions agreed that labor laws had to be made more flexible. Employers would feel less constrained in hiring new workers if they could have short-term contracts, flexible wages, etc. There was a lot of opposition to this. The Europeans opposed to what they thought would be the spread of McJobs, McDonald's-type work, and they tried to develop a combination of flexible jobs but security called flexible service, flexicurity. The exclusion, though, did appear to be developing. In the same time, there would develop a considerable tension between insider workers and the unions and outsider workers. In Denmark, there was the referred to the A team, the privileged insiders, the B team, the losers, and now the C team, those who were completely marginalized. In Germany, there was the two-thirds society. In the UK, there were the socially excluded, a term that is now spreading throughout Europe. In France, there was the RMIsters, the acronym for those who take the RMI benefits, which is the low-tier social benefits. In the Netherlands, called the benefit drawers. The other major change was activation or active labor market policies. The idea was that many work would lead to both economic growth and reduced poverty. Activation focused on those below the labor market, the social assistance recipients. And the welfare state for these people was to be changed from passive, which were disincentives to work, to targeting, sanctions, and selectivity. The welfare programs, the welfare-to-work programs are spreading throughout Europe. And what's interesting, and this is I'd like you to bring up in the discussion, is that countries, even with no welfare state crisis, and even with strong economies, such as Norway, have also adopted active labor market policies for the social assistance recipient. They're directed at the unemployed youth, the long parents, long-term unemployment, etc. And the idea is that the best way to help these people the socially excluded re-enter society is through paid labor. Previously, the concern was to support these people. Now, the idea is to bring them in through society was through active labor market policies, targeting, selectivity, etc. Now, the other significant change with active labor market policies, again, which is really a surprise to an outsider looking in, has been the delegation of these programs to municipalities. Excuse me. To municipalities and regional governments on the theory that they are closer to the employment markets and they would be more adept at getting these people into the work. There also has been an increase in privatization. There's been contracting out, etc. Now, the Europeans claim, especially when I'm over there, they say, well, active labor market policies, or ALMP as they call them, they say they're different from workfare. They're different from workfare. The Europeans maintain that the idea behind the active labor market policies is about rights and opportunities as distinguished from U.S.-style workfare, which is focused on duties and sanctions. Active labor market policies embrace a wide range of practices, human capital development, wage subsidies, employment subsidies, and job creations. They emphasize that there's a combination between carrots and sticks. In contrast, the U.S. Workfare lacks carrots. It is just sticks and focuses on jobs first and sanctions. Now, coinciding with the changes in the national welfare states, there has been a great deal of activity at the European Union level. This started with the European Employment Strategy and the open method of coordination and the development of soft law, and social pillar is one of the pillars of the Employment Strategy was social inclusion, and they had guidelines, national action plans as to how countries should develop their programs to include the increase of people into the paid labor force. There's been a big activity concerning female activities and promoting family-friendly policies. Now, there's a big debate in Europe about the effects of the open method of coordination and the soft law on social inclusion. Many claim that because of this, there's been a big increase at the national level about these issues. Others claim that national ministries are restrictive about who participates in the European Union deliberations. And it's very hard to establish causality between the open method of coordination and the national action plans and then what goes on at the national level. It is claimed that that through this the nations that aren't doing so well will learn from the nations that are doing well, that these programs involving shaming countries, but who knows whether this this works. Claude Barbier, who used to be a member of our group, says the European Union influence has influence because when national governments are debating issues of social inclusion changes, they do refer to the European Union. Now, I want to skip. Now, my time is running out. I want to skip to the last issue of immigration. Immigration has become a major social and political issue in Europe. With the expansion of the European Union, it has facilitated the migration of lower-skilled workers into Western Europe. Remember the big controversy over the Polish plumber? This is especially with the unification of Germany. The main sources of immigration now are from North Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans. Countries that were formerly exporting immigrants are now countries that are receiving immigrants. There are asylum seekers, family reunification, illegal immigrants, children born in Europe. Immigrants, including children born to immigrants in Europe, suffer serious discrimination, housing, employment, education, and the situation is especially dire for illegal countries. Several countries are experiencing political, cultural, and social conflicts between Muslims and native Christian populations. You hear statements coming out of Europe claiming that they are Christian societies. In France, xenophobia was seized by the right wing, but has spread to other political parties. There have been protests and confrontations in several countries. And according to Timothy Smith, many French believe that the social order is falling apart, that violence in the working class suburbs is at an all-time high. The rejection of the proposed European constitution in France and the Netherlands has been interpreted at least in part as a reaction to the possible admission of Turkey into the European Union. The EU has recognized the importance of cross-national immigration and has tried to develop confrontations. Now, the European welfare states, as I started out, are founded on national boundaries and citizenship, which determine who is included and who is excluded from the welfare system. Are these pillars of the welfare state now becoming frayed? Again, quoting Maurizio Ferrara, "But who are the others, the ordinary citizens who are so willing to help? And when thinking of equality, solidarity, welfare, what community do they typically have in mind? It is highly probable that respondents have in mind primarily their fellow nationals and that their home country is the implicit frame of reference for judgments regarding solidarity and redistribution. Social sharing builds on closure. It presupposes the existence of a clearly demarcated and cohesive community whose members feel that they belong to the same whole and that they are linked by reciprocity ties vis-a-vis common risks and similar needs. Thank you.
Okay, I was told to get right into this and not say very much, so that's what I will do. We have our first presenters. Are both of you presenting?
Yes.
And I apologize in advance for probably mispronouncing most of your names, so you can correct me when you come up. I got Bill Seitz right. So Martin Brussig and Matthias Knut from the University of Duisburg-Essen will be our first presenters today, and then they will be followed by Fleming Larsen from Aalborg University, and followed by Ludo Stuyven from Catholic University of Leuven. And then Bill Seitz from SSA will be our discussant. So let's start first with Martin and Matthias.
Martin and I will use these 15 minutes allotted to us trying to give you a little glimpse of the big body of evaluation of the recent German labor market policy reforms. But saying that, it makes me stop because this morning we have been talking about welfare all the time, and now I'm talking about labor market policy reform or activating labor market policy reform. So are we talking about the same thing or aren't we? Joel, in his presentation, has already paved the way a bit to bridge between the discourses of the US and Europe, and just give me one extra minute to say something more on that. In a purely functional sense, actually, I'm talking about something that would be the same as what you call welfare, being the safety net of last resort. But of course, with important differences as to duration of eligibility, there is no five-year rule, and also the fact that even single persons are eligible if they are in need. It doesn't depend on having children. But in a comparative perspective, the nature of things is not just their substance or function. It is as much as that, it is also the way things are framed semantically and lexically and how they are presented in the collective political minds of nations. So I think it does make a difference if these things are framed as active labor market policy reform, sort of taking over social assistance and extending principles that were always present in unemployment insurance into social assistance. Now, of course, it can only be that way if you do have a tradition of active and later activating labor market policies. So what you call welfare to work has a different framing in our context. Let me just go on with a little conceptual mapping exercise. Several writers have tried to map the subject matter, which I think has three clusters. One is on governance, organization, and so on. These things have been talked about this morning. So the kind of things that are delivered depend very much on the construction of the machinery through which they pass. The second thing is the benefit regime, the entitlements, and so on. And the third thing is programs, schemes, instruments. There have been different ways to depict this. Jean-Claude Barbier has distinguished between the activation of social protection and the activation of persons. Rick van Berkel, who is with us together with Van der Borgi, has differentiated between operational reforms and formal reforms. The German case has led me to elaborate on the relationship between the benefit regime and the governance of things, because the radical change of benefits and the question which benefits exist and who is responsible for them, of course, has repercussions on the governance. And actually, the interaction between the governance and the benefit regime is what, in my framing, constitutes a regime of social protection, which is one level below Esping Anderson's welfare regimes, which are not uniform, as some people tend to think. Actually, each welfare regime consists of several distinctive regimes of social protection which may contradict each other in their norms and basic mechanisms and which may also interact in a national context. If you compare the European countries in terms of benefit reform and organizational reform, actually Germany, this sclerotic late reformer, stands out as the most radical one, because you have to believe this now, because we don't have the time to elaborate on this, so believe it or not, but Germany was the only one to, within one legal second, changing the governance and the benefit structure at the same time. Nobody else did that, and I don't know whether it was a good idea, because it created a lot of problems and constitutional struggles that we are going to mention later. But anyway, what we have here is the interaction between a radical benefit reform and a radical governance reform. See, this was the old system of the benefits, where by on the upper level, by paying contributions, you would get unemployment benefits, and after these were exhausted, you got unemployment assistance, which was sort of a follow-on benefit, but which was very much geared according to the Bismarckian model of status maintenance. So even though it was tax-funded and means-tested, the amount was geared to your former earnings. And at the bottom level, we had social assistance, which is, well, near to what you would call welfare. Now, as the main feature of the reform was doing away with this follow-on benefit and letting people drop into a new benefit, a means-tested basic income support for job seekers. Notice the British wording. This is Blair speak in the German language, which is flat rate of unlimited duration. And the former recipient community of social assistance was split in half according to the old criterion of being able to work or considered able to work and not able to work. The minority not able to work is continuing on what was social assistance, whereas those considered to be able to work for 3 days, for 3 hours a day, are now into the new benefit. So actually, for those people able to work and without insurance-based entitlements, the two benefits, social assistance and unemployment assistance, have been merged. Now, the question, of course, is who is going to administer that? Because one thing was a federal thing, a social security thing, and the other thing was a municipal responsibility. The government plans first said the agencies for work would alone also administer the new system, but there was fierce political opposition against this. And it was ideological and political, but of course also it was a problem for the municipalities what to do with their excess staff who would lose clients. So then there was a complicated political compromise by which consortia were formed, so-called joint ventures between the Federal Employment Service and the municipalities to administer the new benefit and the new activation regime. But on top of this one compromise, there was another compromise that 69 municipalities got the right to do the job alone. So the main question of the evaluation then became, which of these two systems is better? Which model of governance activates persons more effectively, the consortium model or the purely municipal model? And of course, and the question is, why is this so? And this question, of course, links the two levels that I pointed out before, the benefit regime level and the governance level. Now, Martin will continue with some results of the evaluation.
Well, I'll be very brief about the results. I have here a table with a summary of a summary, so to say, and the results are mixed, but if you look a little bit closer, then the consortia job centers do better. They are not better in all aspects, but they are better in more aspects, and they are better in a more important aspect, such as quitting the benefit and taking up work which is paid sufficiently to quit the benefit. Now the question, why is this so, is harder to answer. But we found two different alternative styles of activation in Germany, which we called demanding activation and caring activation, with selective affinities to the different models of governance within the basic income support, the consortia job centers and the municipalized job centers. Now, what does demanding and caring mean? In a demanding activation strategy, there's a tougher approach with more sanction, while in the caring activation strategy, there's a softer approach with fewer sanctions. In the demanding activation, the focus is on employment, while on the caring activation, the focus is on employability. In the demanding activation strategy, there are sooner but less comprehensive interviews with new customers, while in the caring activation strategy, the interviews start later, but when they start, they are more comprehensive. In the demanding activation strategy, the overarching aim is to get people off the benefit, preferably by getting them into living wage work, while in the caring activation strategy, the target is to get people into jobs, even if these jobs are small jobs. And there are differences in subsidies. The demanding activation strategy subsidized employers for hiring, while the caring activation strategy subsidized customers for working. Now, in the meantime, the legal discussion continued, and the Federal Constitutional Court ruled the consortia as unconstitutional. That is, their existence is not justified by the German Constitution. They have, therefore, to close until 2010, that is, until the end of the next year. Also, thanks to the German Constitution, it is not possible to extend the municipalized job centers beyond their experimental status to Germany as a whole. I don't want to go too much into detail here and must refer to our paper, but from today's perspective, there are two scenarios about the future of the governance of the basic income support. According to a first scenario, the consortia, which have to split up, separate into two different units, which we call a separate fulfillment. And the fully municipalized model remains then the only one-stop model. Now, to create one-stop agencies was one of the big promises of the Hartz reform, and therefore it will be likely in this scenario that the municipal model will be extended beyond its current 69 local units. In the second scenario, both houses of parliament will succeed and create a constitutional amendment to legalize the consortia. But in this case, it is likely that the options for the fully municipalized model will be extended as a political price for the constitutional amendment. In either case, the result will be that the weaker performing model will be the political winner. This result is a paradox, but what does this paradox tell us about activation? We came to three conclusions about that. The first conclusion is that activation is a multi-level phenomenon. The governance reform may depend on a benefit reform, and the implementation depends on options for governance available. The second conclusion is that activation is embedded in larger contexts of the society. The governance issues of activating labor market policies have implications for national governance, for the national governance framework. And the third conclusion is about the interaction between or the hybridization of different subregimes of social protection within one national context. If there is a system of social protection formed as assistance in the case of unemployment, and if this system coexists with another system of social protection formed as insurance in the case of unemployment, then assistance will be traditionally linked to the local governments, while the insurance system is linked to the national government or to the unions in the Ghent model. Now, the activation paradigm and the one-stop service fashion cut across the assistance-insurance divide and prompting local and national governments to cooperate. Now, creating these cooperations or creating business between national and local governments with uncertain outcomes, as we have seen in the German case, depends more on national governance and politics than on the rationales of activating labor market policy. And I would like to conclude here. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Fleming Larson, and I was asked to be quick, but I wasn't asked to overlook speakers, so I apologize. After Fleming will be Els Sol from University of Amsterdam. Fleming.
Thanks. And coming from Denmark, this is a nice opportunity to finally make a presentation without using the word flexicurity. So this, yeah, now I used it. So, but anyway, this is about the employment policy, and my focus this is on the transformation of employment and social policy. How this is linked to changes in governance and implementation systems. And the argument put forward here is that policy making and policy transformation is increasingly a question of how governance and implementation structures are designed, and also that the policy making or policy transformation has more or less conscious been moved away from the traditional political arenas and instead become a public management issue. And what I think is very important to stress is that it's often clouded in these technocratic discussions and debates on in efficiency and cost savings, as we did at the dinner last night, Rick. prove this thesis, but perhaps illustrate one case study on how this could happen in real life. I would use a case study of the Danish the implementation of employment services in the Danish municipalities, or actually two, as we've made a case study or implementation study in 2001 and a similar one in 2008. But first, I want to make a distinction between different types of reforms in this analysis, because we can make a distinction between formal policy reforms and operational policy reforms. And we have, when we talk about formal policy reforms, it's about the content or the substance of legislation, programs, schemes. And when we talk about operational reforms, it's the governing of the implementation structure, both for administration of benefits and the provision of services. And you, as you can see, there's different research traditions too involved in these two kinds of types of reforms. What we have been seeing in many OECD countries is that there was a movement towards what we could, we sometimes give them different kind of labels, but it's kind of work first or workfare reforms. When we talk about all these formal reforms coming up from the mid 90s until the early into the new millennium, and some of this has already been said today. If you know all this, what this includes, this kind. And it's not to say that we are moving towards any kind of convergence between these OECD countries. We have different starting points. We have different political context. We have a different cultural context. So we cannot talk about similar policies on this field. But after all, it's really striking that we're all moving towards some kind of work first policy in this sense. What we have seen now for the, I would say, last 5 or 10 years is that these kind of formal reforms have been followed up by a lot of operational reforms. You could say that it's not only the unemployed who is going to be activated in this, but also the system dealing with the unemployed is going to be activated. And the kind of reforms we have been seeing is that the much criticized public employment services has been dissolved, and often they are replaced with new implementation units, and this, at least on paper, implies a decentralization of this PES system. We have seen the creation of new unified and simplified implementation units in some of the North European countries. We have municipalization, we have marketization, and also in the north of the European country, the decorporatization. And this is followed up by, you could call it I call it a decentralized centralization in the sense that it's a kind of principal agent thinking behind these new operational reforms. And we have this new public management instrument and techniques. Some of them have been mentioned today. Performance management is of course, very profound in this new kind of steering mechanism. Furthermore, we have centralized defined procedures for how to work on this field, both when it comes to methods and instruments, profiling systems and other kind of similar systems. So it is a kind of decentralized centralization, you could call it. And these kinds of reforms is now evident in a number of OECD countries. But how does this work? What is happening when you introduce this operational reform? Do the designers succeed in activating these implementations system? Is it possible to change the policy through operational reforms? And I will take my starting point in these two studies of the implementation of employment services in the Danish municipalities in 2001 and 2008. If we look at the Danish employment system, the Danish employment policies, we could see there was a lot of reforms, formal reforms, from the late 90s, and they were all moving towards what we could call work first or social disciplining. That's the label we use in a Danish term. I don't know if it's translatable, but that's at least the concept I use in the book about these implementation studies. But what you could see is that nearly all of these formal reforms, they were moving the policy, or trying to move the policy towards this social disciplining or work-first approach. And actually, some make completely wrong description of the Danish system because they were looking at the legislation. The very famous book from Lødemel and Tricky, they defined Denmark as a workfare country with a centralized, codified administrative framework and a well-defined sanctioning policy. But it's completely wrong from my point of view. At that time, it was completely wrong, because if you look at the implemented policy, it was completely different. And that was also what our study showed. But here's the result from the findings from the study from 2001. And what you could see was that the social security part, or the passive line, actually was a major part of this policy. And also this, what we labeled the social integration policy, was a major part. And only for a very, very small group, a minority, the young people coming from high school, yeah, there was social disciplining. So it was absolutely not the formal reforms that was implemented as intended. And as we'll quote from another Danish study, saying that there was a huge political awareness of this, as a quote from one of the decision makers saying that, yeah, we were making it. There was more whip or stick in the legislation than political intended, because they knew that this would be softened up in the implementation process. But why is this policy softened up? If you look at the Danish system, we have a two-tier system. We have a centralized and hierarchical steered public employment services for the insured unemployed, but it has often been softened by that this has been a corporatist structure. We have the social partner has been a part of the steering of this system. And then we have a decentralized and nearly autonomous municipalities who has been doing the services for the uninsured unemployed. That was at least the case until they made the new operational reforms in Denmark coming up from 2007. But actually they started earlier already with a major reform in 2002. What they're trying to do is merging these PES and the municipalities in new job centers. And what they're trying to do is that they say that the municipalities are allowed now to take over the responsibility. But to do this, they have to accept the new logic of steering and control and giving them less autonomy. And they are now under the control from a lot of what you could call a new public management instruments. At the same time, you are dissolving the PES system, and that means that the social partners, they have lost much of their regional power and influence. On top of this, we have a parallel system with some of the employment services now is contracted out for private profit actors. And this is the system. I skipped this. I know Henning will, Jorgensen will have this slide too. So, but what is the explicit and implicit objectives of these central designers? Yeah, you want to ensure that there's an equal treatment. They say they want to have a better coordinated and integrated implementation structure. But what is all to do with that they want to gain strategic control over these municipalities? So this is, again, this is a decentralized centralization. But they're not saying this explicitly. And then, of course, they want to push implementation towards work first. It's also want to minimize the political responsibility for the minister, and then they want to get rid of the social partners. And have these designers succeeded in doing this? Yes, actually. This case study I've made of the municipal implementation from 2008 at least show that they seem to have succeeded. They have changed the way of organizing the services significantly. This has to do with some of these new steering mechanisms. But what we see is a much more bureaucratic system that then give a lot of other kind of problems because now they have all the problem with administration and documentation. But a clear shift in the organizational mode is visible. And then there's really striking that the local implementation agents' perception of what is kind of policy is that we are going to implement here. This has been completely changed for only these few years between the two studies. There's now a much higher accept of this social discipline or work first as the policy to be implemented. So I come to the conclusion. The local implementation agents' understanding of the policy has undergone marked changes towards a work first approach. And the changes have largely been brought about by the changes in the organizational form. And then I want to make some very short theoretical reflection on this, because my theoretical starting point for this analysis was an assumption about that different policy types is affiliated with different kind of implementation conditions. And therefore, you have to be aware of this when you do your implementation study. And then I've taken up the work of Rothstein, who talks about matching different organizational forms with different policy types. And he says you have to identify the DNA of the policy. And then in order to analyze the implementation process and what kind of organizational forms that is needed, he talks about an IDO theory. It depends on theory. to secure successful implementation, the organizational form should fit the policy, the policy type. And then, of course, here we have this phenomenon that the work first is work first approach is interrelated to this to standardized services. So it's very well fit that we now have a much more bureaucratic organization, along with that you can see a change in the policy that is implemented. So this analysis fit very well into this theory, but there seems to be a connection between the desire to introduce a more profound work first or social disciplining approach and the changes described in the municipal organization. But I think there's a problem in this, because it seems to suffer from an accelerated, rational and functional understanding of the chronology of the process. Because what you can see is that the organizational forms, the creation of the organizational forms may precede policy formulation. This at least seems very evident in the Danish case. A thesis could therefore be that there will be many other areas of welfare policy where it can be seen that policy changes are introduced more or less deliberately by means of especially NPM-inspired changes. And that's why I think that we need to examine in depth this interaction between policy types and institutional change, bearing in mind that institutional changes could be the first step. So I think we have to go beyond this discussion on how effective the different management systems are, whether they are public or they are private, and to discuss their impact. Instead, we need to discuss their impact on public policymaking. It's not what works, but how it works, as Evelyn said. And then we also need another thing, is that we have to combine the research with the people who are dealing with categorizing, analyzing these changes in labor market and social policy. We have to combine this with the research done about governance and new public management and implementation research. Thank you.